Welcome to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. This series is brought to you by the UMass Office of Equity and Inclusion and features members of the university community and other experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. In these episodes, we'll learn about the work and experiences of our guests and gain insight from their expertise. Your host for this podcast is Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Interim Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion and Professor of Sport Management in the Eisenberg School of Management. And now, here's Nef.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Dignity, Respect, and Action podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nef Walker. Our last episode wrapped up our Black History Month series about the Black experience at UMass and a fascinating interview with Professor John Bracey and Dr. Whitney Battle-Baptiste on the Black Presence Initiative. Today, we are kicking off a month-long series in honor of Women's History Month, where we are going to talk about women and gender diversity on campus here at UMass and in broader community and academic contexts. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome the director of the Stonewall Center and the Trans Policy Clearinghouse Coordinator for Campus Pride, Dr. Jenny Beeman, to talk about gender diversity and community at UMass. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So I always like to start the show with introductions. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and the work that you are doing at UMass Stonewall Center and with Campus Pride?
Sure. So I have been director of the Stonewall Center for 15 years. Prior to that, I was in a similar role at Ohio State. At both institutions, a major focus was making the institutions more trans inclusive. When I came to UMass, there were no trans supported policies in place. And in fact, the administration had fought efforts to get gender inclusive restrooms on campus. And since then, we have become probably the most trans-supportive college in the country when it comes to policies. Certainly, we have more trans-supportive policies than any other public university in the country. And in fact, I was involved back when I was a grad student in 1996 at the University of Iowa in getting the first trans-supportive policy in the country. We added gender identity to the non-discrimination policy. And at the time, I hadn't realized that no other institution had done that. And when I did, it really got me thinking that this is something that really needs to be done at all institutions. And so started advocating and started tracking the policies of trans inclusion at different institutions and advocating for different institutions to be becoming more trans inclusive, and eventually became working for Campus Pride, doing that for them and also consulting with institutions to be more trans inclusive, as well as writing a lot of articles and a couple of books on trans inclusion and the needs and experiences of trans students.
Thank you for that, that introduction and a bit of the history of where we were as a campus, you know, 15 or so years ago, and how far we've come, because I think that history is important so that we can celebrate that, right? But also that we can understand this is a process of constantly evolving and progressing and getting better and becoming more inclusive of the various groups on campus, particularly the trans community. I'm really interested in the work that you're doing to support transgender students. And I know that you've also written quite extensively, as you've alluded to, about the experiences and needs of trans students. Can you talk with us today about what kinds of supports trans students need to thrive as part of our campus community?
Okay, so research, including my own research, including the UMass Campus Climate Survey, shows that trans students have a very low sense of belonging on campus, probably more than any other group, view the campus climate quite negatively because of institutional individual discrimination, which leads them to experience very high rates of gender minority stress, which leads to negative academic mental health outcomes. So we need to change that, obviously. We need to create a greater sense of belonging among trans students. We need to create more inclusive campus climates. We need to basically enable trans students to be seen and to be seen as themselves. So we need to do things like making sure that the name and pronouns that students use for themselves are reflected in all institutional context, that when students are continually misgendered, that that's seen as a form of harassment and is addressed that way. We need to make sure that we're focusing on gender identity is how we look at our students rather than how they were assigned at birth. So for example, needing to make housing based upon gender identity and not how students were assigned. And that's something that, that UMass is moving toward, which I'm really excited by, as well as making sure that we give non-binary students the ability to be seen as non-binary. We try to move away from how institutions are based upon a gender binary. A lot of trans students are really resilient, but we need to really bolster that resilience by providing academic and emotional supports, helping them to really develop a support network.
Dr. Beeman, can you give us an example of what that support network may look like? I know it looks very different depending on the person and the individual and the circumstances, but just for our listeners, an example of what it might look like to support our trans students.
Well, as I mentioned, a lot of LGBT students, especially T students, don't feel a great sense of belonging from the institution. So if they're going to persist, they need to feel a sense of belonging someplace so that if they have been misgendered in a classroom by a professor for the umpteenth time, they have a place they can go and get support, someone they can vent to, who's going to get them, who's going to understand them. Maybe it's another trans person who's in a similar situation of being misgendered, so really gets how invalidating, how marginalizing that is to somebody. Or maybe it's a cis friend who just understands on a very visceral level just how horrible that is and is there for that person. So trans individuals really need those folks around them who they can go to help bolster them up, to make them be able to feel like someone has their back when a lot of the institution feels really like it doesn't have their back, unfortunately.
Thank you. I appreciate you diving a little bit deeper to help our listeners understand that. Have the needs of LGBTQ plus students and the trans community in particular changed this past year with remote learning and COVID-19? And I also want to welcome you to, as we're having this conversation, if I am misidentifying, misusing any of our acronyms, please feel free to jump in and correct me. Because this is a learning progress for me, a process for me as well. Although, you know, I do some research in trying to understand the experiences of queer and queer gendered folks in sport. I too am constantly learning. So you being much more of the expert than I am in this area, please correct me so that our listeners are learning throughout this process as well.
It's a learning experience for all of us, really.
Yes.
Terminology is constantly changing and more words get added all the time. So we need to continually be working on our lexicon. COVID has really had a dramatic and in some ways traumatic effect on our LGBTQ students, and especially our trans students. And because you don't have that support network. If you depend for a sense of belonging on friends at the college, all of a sudden they're not there or are not there in the same way. They're there to a lesser degree, perhaps, as they're maybe also home or away from campus, or you don't get a chance to see them as much because everyone is sort of socially distancing and separating. So it can be really tough to be able to have that same level of support and to have people to go to as resources. And for some students, they're having to be home, and home may not be a good environment. They may not be out at home. So some students nationally go back into the closet, having to having spent this past year, now year more, at home. And so that's just so defeating and so traumatic for a lot of people to no longer be able to be themselves, to have to live a double life. I know folks who have to sort of hide themselves and secretly be engaging in LGBT events or having conversations with people because their families are not supportive or they're not out to their families. And that's just a horrible situation to be in. Or for incoming students who haven't had supportive communities, were not able to be out in their high school because of the climate, or are not out to their families because they fear their family's reaction, and have been looking forward for maybe in some cases years getting to college to finally be able to be themselves, to come out, to have friends who are LGBT and to be involved in LGBT events. And all of a sudden, that's not there for them. They're stuck at home for another year, or they were able to get to a campus, but it's not the same experience because they don't have the chance to participate in events, or there aren't events that are being held, and certainly they don't have the ability to be meeting as many other LGBT folks on campus. And so it's a very isolating, alien experience. And so it's not what they've been looking forward to. So this year for a lot of students, it's just been really hard. It's been going backward for some students, or it's been just basically putting their lives on hold for another year.
Thank you for sharing that. I think the stories and the narratives that you are sharing about the experiences in particular of our trans community, our trans students, and having to manage COVID as well as the climates, as you mentioned, whether at, you know, their hometown or quite literally inside of their house with their family, I'm not sure many of us are thinking about the difficulty that this has caused for that particular community and for having to deal with this particular nuance related to COVID, right? Like we think of other things like, you know, not having the interactions, the normal social interactions that students would have or first year students would have on campus. But we don't think about someone literally having to go back in the closet, for instance, right? Or having to hide parts of their identities 24/7 because they don't have the campus community to, for some, escape to. So thank you for sharing that. How is the Stonewall Center helping meet the needs of our trans community? You've mentioned some of this already, but if you could spend some time sharing some of the work that you're doing with us.
Sure. So along with all of the trans supportive policies that we have helped put in place, we also encourage CCPH to start a trans support group. And now that group is 5 years old. And of course, this past year has been online. We also ourselves run an LGBTQ+ support group that has also for this past year been online. We do events for trans people specifically. Like this coming week, we're doing this fantastic trans person of faith event where we have different trans religious figures talking about their experience, their faith journeys, and how they have brought together their religion and being trans and finding a good place for that and finding an accepting religious community. We also do events for other people to become educated, to learn about trans experiences. Beyond the trainings we do, we do events like later this semester, we're doing a panel discussion on trans rights during the Biden administration with the leaders of trans and LGBTQ rights groups. Probably it's the only time that all these leaders of different national groups have been in the same place, in the same room with each other, even though it's a virtual room. So that's going to be pretty amazing. We're also doing a panel on trans studies with some of the leading trans scholars in the country. So we do those kind of events as well to educate people, as well as help trans people learn about their histories, about their cultures, and about their experiences too, which you need to do.
Absolutely. And I love the idea of the intersectional approach, right? The intersection of religion in particular, and in this case, our trans community. I love the idea of addressing that as well, because I feel like often when we think about these various marginalized identities on our campus, we often forget that there are intersections that people are navigating of their various, often sometimes multiple marginalized identities that they're having to navigate on a campus community. So I love the fact that you're highlighting those voices. So what kind of programs and supports do you see developing or expanding in the future?
One of the things that I'm very excited about is that this past year, the University of California system implemented a policy to have students be able to indicate a non-binary gender marker. That has always been a challenge. I've been pushing for that at UMass for years. And what I've been told is, oh, we can't do that because the federal government requires us to report data that's either M or F. Well, the UC system has found a way to work with that. And I'm very excited to be having UMass also do that. And I got support to be thinking about how we could bring that about in, after COVID, to be able to give students ability to be who they are, which is just so important, I think. And also their policy is really great policy in terms of name, respecting the name that students use for themselves. And for a trans student, looking at their dead name, their legal name, kind of like we treat Social Security number, that's something that no one ever reveals, that's like secret information that only people with high levels of clearance can ever see. So thinking in those terms for how we look at someone's dead name. And so that's not going to be something people are ever going to see, that no one's ever going to be able to use that. So I really love their policy, and I'm really looking forward to us being have something similar here. Also this past week, the Common Application, which is what UMass and about 900 other schools use for their admissions application, announced that they're adding questions where students can indicate the name they go by, indicate their pronouns. And I'm working with them on how that they're going to word these questions, and also talking with UMass about, okay, we're going to now have this information on our admission form. So we need to make sure that we integrate that into our systems. Because right now, a student can add their pronouns to their records. We're one of about 50 colleges in the country that allow that to happen. Students can indicate the name that they go by and their records, but it's a process of having to add that information, to go through steps to make that happen. This will happen automatically, so that students, if they put that on the application, that will then transfer into their records so that it'll be there. They don't have to navigate that system and don't have to worry about being misgendered, misnamed, unless they do something to prevent that. So I'm really excited about that opportunity and looking forward to being able to have UMass integrate that into our system.
No, that sounds extremely exciting and, you know, in some ways well overdue. I also want to take a moment and just thank you. I think because you've been here for a while, and because you do such good work often quietly, we don't recognize how lucky we are to have you on our campus. So I want to recognize how lucky we are to have someone like you that is such a powerhouse across the country and in this particular field, to have you as a resource on our campus. So again, thank you for all you've done, all you continue to do. And I absolutely want to highlight to our listeners that we are incredibly fortunate to have you here. So something I learned recently is that the UMass Stonewall Center was actually one of the first LGBTQ campus centers in the U.S. when it opened in 1985. I'm really intrigued by the history of LGBTQ plus activism. Can you talk to us a bit about the history of activism here at UMass?
Sure. Yes, we are the third oldest campus LGBTQ plus center after ones at Michigan and Penn. And it came about because a report that looked at LGB, we didn't talk about the T then, found that LGB students faced a really hostile climate on campus. That, for example, students could not be out in the residence halls without having their doors defaced or having death threats, which actually led UMass to create what was the country's first LGBT, well, LGB then floor, called the 220 floor, now called Spectrum. Students, when they did events, LGBT events, faced counter demonstrators. When people did Gay Pride Week, one year posters were defaced and said, hang a homo week. So it was a really intensely hostile climate on campus. LGB folks and allies rallied and pushed the administration to do something, which led to the report, which encouraged the center to be started. My predecessor as Stonewall Director, Felice Yeskel, wrote the report and was tasked with creating the center. And in the late 80s, early 90s, it was really the only safe space on campus for LGB students. Every place else was pretty hostile. So talking with alumni from back in the day, they just really appreciate how much the Stonewall Center was the only place on campus that they felt that they can go to and really be themselves. A couple of years ago, SEPA did a really great video about our history, which captures a lot of this and a lot more. And that's on our website under the About Us tab. So if people want to know more, that's a really great video to watch.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. Our office fields a lot of questions from folks about allyship and how they can become better accomplices, right? Or as people have begun to say, co-conspirators. What does genuine allyship with the trans community look like? And how can we move beyond just pronouns, which seems like, again, the floor, right? The bare minimum that people can do to show respect and treat trans folks with dignity.
Sure. Well, pronouns are really important, though. You know, to be providing a space for people to be able to indicate their pronouns, for people to be sharing their pronouns. I don't want to minimize that, because that's just so important, because that's a major way that trans people feel invalidated is being misgendered and people making gendered assumptions about them. But I think a larger thing is really to avoid gendered language altogether, unless you know how someone identifies. And if we learn to be using gendered language, right? To be saying sir and ma'am and Mr. and Ms., to be seen as being polite. And we don't need to be doing that to be seen as polite. So we need to be unlearning that. We also need to be recognizing the ways in which gender is put forward as a binary and really to work against that. So interrupting that whenever we see that happening, such as on the forms that different departments or offices may use. We are going to be unveiling, hopefully in the next month, a Moodle course on LGBTQ plus allyship that folks can take. It's a way for us to go on a larger scale than simply the presentations that we're able to give to departments and offices. This will be a way that more people can show their allyship, can take this and then indicate that they want to be seen as being an allyship and be listed. Because right now we do it, but it's more on an office or departmental level basis. And we often don't get the invites to do it for everyone in an office or department. This would allow anyone to be able to take it, so they don't need to wait until whoever heads their office or department to see this as something to do. Anyone can then take it and be listed. So hopefully it will give us a lot more folks to be visible on campus, because it is so important to have those people who are visible as supporters, so that trans and LGBT students more generally know who they can go to. Because unfortunately, in this day and age, you can't trust that someone's going to be supportive, that someone's going to be someone you can talk to who's going to get it, or at least mostly get it, or try to get it. So having those that visibility of seeing a name listed on a website or having images in an office that shows someone as a supporter, it's just so important. I've heard so many stories from people who are trans who feel so much more at ease when they see something that indicates someone is a trans supportive person, so they feel like they can be themselves, or when someone ask them like what pronouns they use for themselves and doesn't assume that, or ask what name they go by, not assuming that whatever name that they have in front of them is the name the student used for themselves. Those small things really add up. Those are really actually very big things for someone who's trans, who wants to feel like they're being seen, that they're being validated. So I don't want to discount the importance of those small measures.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, I'm thinking about myself as a faculty member and some of the things that as you were going through the ways that you can signal to the trans community or to the LGBTQ plus community that you're an ally is, I think, as a faculty member on the first day of the class, right? So something that I do, and I'm not suggesting that I get this perfect, and I'm not suggesting that folks follow exactly what I do, but something that I've been doing now for, I guess I started it maybe the second year after coming to UMass, so 2013. And I believe it was after attending some of your events, so some of the beginning of the semester welcome events that you had. Somehow you communicated something to me that made me on my actual form that I do, that I pass around the first day of classes where people can, you know, sign into the class like a roster. I have, what name do you go by? What is your preferred name? And I've been doing that since, and preferred pronouns since, you know, 2013. I think something else that I do is that I make it my purpose to share a lot about myself. So I let my students know a little bit about me on the first day, that I'm married to a woman, for instance, that I have a brother that identifies as non-binary, and just sort of sharing those details, as well as, you know, the fact that I'm Black and I'm from the South and I love barbecue, right? Like I share lots and lots of details about myself, but I do that in hopes that there is a student that something about me resonates with them. And I also make an effort to share my marginalized identities, the identities that I have that have been marginalized with students as well. And again, this is just one way that I, as one person on campus, as a faculty member and administrator, how I go about trying to create a space where people feel welcomed to, one, share and also be vulnerable in some ways. So I think, you know, certainly what you've shared is additional information and coming from more of an expert than myself, but I share my story to say that everyone can do their part and everyone can do something to create these spaces where people feel seen. So thank you so much, Dr. Beeman. Is there anything else that you would want to add to close to our conversation today?
Sure. I'm going to go back to something you said earlier about language and correcting you. I'm going to call you in a little bit here. And around name and pronouns, we don't want people saying preferred.
Yes.
Because it's not really a preference. The name I use for myself is the only name you can call me. There's not like, this is what I would want you to do, but you could do something else. No, this is only what you can do. So trying to get people away from that preferred language is one of the things that I, you know, the Common App, I've been telling them like, hey, you know, we can't be using preferred for this because that's what they wanted to do. And I say, no, we can't be doing that because that's offensive. You know, for some people, they do have a preferred name. Like maybe someone who's named Thomas prefers to be Tom.
Nefertiti.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But for trans people, that's really not a preference. This is the affirmed name. This is the lived name. This is the name that I go by. And I love your practice of what you do in the classroom. Other faculty or sometimes staff in meetings who are leading a meeting, I see them introduce themselves and say, you know, this is my name. I go by these pronouns, so they sort of set an atmosphere where pronouns are not assumed and people all have the space to share their pronouns. And, you know, you do it by passing something around or having people fill out something other people will go around and have people share the name that they use for themselves, and if they want to also include their pronouns. I think it's important to recognize that we're not trying to impose pronouns on people, that people have to share their pronouns, but giving a space for people to be able to do so if they want to. So we're trying to walk a line here, trying to find a sweet spot for people who want to indicate their pronouns, perhaps because they want to avoid being misgendered, because people make an assumption about what pronouns they use, and those are not the pronouns they actually use for themselves. Other people, though, may not feel safe or comfortable in that space sharing their pronouns, and so don't want to put them out there. So not requiring people to have to indicate their pronouns, but encouraging people that want to do so to share that. So it's trying to balance those two different needs out.
So first, I want to thank you for calling me out or calling me in on that, because that is a mistake. I know better, and I still make the mistake of using the term preferred. So I appreciate that. One, for me, so that I can get better at it, but also for our listeners. Another point that you bring up that I think I wrote it down to make sure that we cover it is just how do you disrupt those moments where someone is being misgendered or using the wrong terminology? Like you just did. I know in the past, the way I've done it is, I've just said the correct pronoun, the pronoun that I know to be true because this person has shared with me, right? So if someone is suggesting, they're misgendering someone, I will just say, no, they, or I'll just say, no, he, no, she, and just keep going. I don't make a big, hoopla over it. And typically the person will say, I apologize, you're right. And we just keep going. And I do that because the folks that I've been around have appreciated that way of disrupting. So I think if you just really quickly for a moment, if you can share some ways that people might disrupt these moments of either misgendering, again, being an ally, being a co-conspirator, and creating an inclusive space.
Yeah, what you just shared is a great way to do it in the moment. If you're part of a conversation and somebody misgenders someone, whether that person is there in the conversation as well or not, to simply point that out, not make a big deal of it, but just point it out and move on. If the person is there and is misgendered, you can talk to them afterward and say, hey, I saw that happened. That really sucked. Do you want me to talk to that person on your behalf? Maybe you didn't feel comfortable calling it in at the moment and making an issue of it. But you also take someone aside afterward and say, hey, in that conversation back there, you misgendered so-and-so, that person uses these pronouns, I think one of the big mistakes is letting it go, because it encourages misbehavior, whether the person is consciously or unconsciously doing it. It needs to be interrupted so that, because misgendering is invalidating, it is harassment when it comes down to it. If someone's repeatedly misgendering someone, that's harassment, and it needs to be addressed. It needs to be interrupted. And I think the other part of that piece is if you're the person who's been called in on the misgendering, that you take it from a place of someone wanting to help you. So say thank you. If a third party says, hey, just so you know, so-and-so uses these pronouns, that you thank the person, because they're taking a chance to be raising this issue with you. So compliment them, express that you are appreciating the fact that they're taking the time, putting themselves out there, especially if this is someone who may have power over you, to be indicating that they screwed up here. Also, if you're being corrected by the person who you misgendered, it's important simply to not make a big deal of it, to say, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll do better in the future. And just leave it at that and not make a huge deal of it. As something gets misgendered all the time, it's really awkward for someone to go on and say, oh God, I'm sorry, I'm just not used to this. You know, I'm old, I didn't grow up with this kind of thing. I don't want to hear that. You just screwed up. You just made me feel bad. And now what? You expect me to feel bad for you because this is a learning experience that you should be learning? No, just simply apologize and do better, right? So it's important that people are cognizant of their own privilege and not be expecting a trans person to feel sorry for them because they have not really learned this and should have.
Thank you so much for that. Dr. Veeman, thank you so much for joining the pod today. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you, as it always is, but it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast to talk about the Stonewall Center and supporting LGBTQIA+ folks in our community here at UMass. The work you're doing is so incredibly important, and we absolutely appreciate you. And for our listeners, thank you for tuning in to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. Keep tuning in this month to learn more about women and gender diversity at UMass. We have an exciting lineup, including interviews with Dr. Rachel Walker in the College of Nursing, Associate Provost for Data Analytics, Dr. Anne Marie Russell, Class of 21 alum Taylor Mickens, and College of Humanities and Fine Arts Dean, Dr. Barbara Krothheimer. Thank you.